Lest We Forget, Volume 5, Number 3. This issue focuses on the key events that took place in James White's life as a leader of the Advent movement in our formative years. We'll begin with an article entitled Qualified for the Job by Fred Bischoff. Then we will hear how God worked through James White to establish the publishing work in Streams of Light, the publishing work by Richard Cooper. Next, Marlene Steinwig will relate a biographical sketch called James White, A Man of Action. Next, we will hear When God Speaks, encouragements given by Ellen White to live a balanced, healthful life. And we'll conclude with a special insert that we think you will find most interesting, entitled Ellen and James White Comment on the Battle for James's Health. Qualified for the Job by Fred Bischoff. James S. White possessed both the assets and the liabilities of a true leader. A review of these and of his experiences provides encouragement and caution alike to those who are called to lead today and to those who are called to follow, whether it be in a family or in a church. Chosen by God. God has selected my husband and given him special qualifications, natural ability, and an experience to lead out his people in the advance work. Early signs of leadership. James White had a lifetime total of just 29 weeks of formal education. Therefore, his breadth of understanding and literary ability came more from his exposure to the practical duties of life and his personal application to study and investigation than to formal studies. His first recorded leadership role was before age 20. He was especially successful in school government, reducing to an orderly and studious condition schools which had been notorious for their unruly and unmanageable character. The ability to lead men and women to Christ. His next leadership experience came at age 21, after he heard William Miller and Joshua V. Himes speak in September 1842. During the winter months of 1842 and 1843, traveling with a borrowed horse and a patched-up bridle and saddle, James led over 1,000 men and women to Christ. This work of spiritual leadership continued after the passing of the time, as he worked to encourage the Advent believers and combat fanaticism. Following God's Leading. In the early days of our work, the Lord did designate Elder James White as one who, in connection with his wife, and under the Lord's special guidance, was to take a leading part in the advancement of this work. Through the testimonies of his Spirit, he had imparted to him great light. He had cautioned, warned, reproved, and encouraged. When God, through visions given his wife, instructed James at age 27 to publish the light that was shining upon our pathway, he soon began printing Present Truth. Leaders are often called to start out small and selflessly. James White clearly manifested this level of commitment, and the work was carried forward at a great sacrifice of strength and means. Building up new endeavors. The earnest efforts of my husband to build up the institutions in our midst, I also saw registered in the ledger of heaven. Bringing order and stability. At age 28, James began to call for the support of traveling ministers and appealed for the believers to move in gospel order. His first carefully developed series of articles on gospel order he published in the Review when he was 32, while living in New York in December 1853. In 1860, at the age of 39, he led out in the decision to incorporate the publishing association legally, choose a church name, and organize the local churches to own church properties. In May of 1863, the General Conference was organized with six states represented. James White was unanimously elected president, but declined the position, not wanting it to appear that he had worked for church organization in order to be its head. An instrument of justice. James had elevated views of the Lord's claims upon all who profess his name, of their duty to stand in defense of the widow and the fatherless, to be kind to the poor, to help the needy. He would jealously guard the interests of his brethren that no unjust advantage should be taken of them. Often misunderstood and not appreciated. I was shown that the position of my husband has been a very difficult one. A pressure of care and labor has been upon him. His brethren in the ministry have not had these burdens to bear, and they have not appreciated his labors. I was shown that his relation to the people of God was similar in some respects to that of Moses to Israel. There were murmurers against Moses when in adverse circumstances, and there have been murmurers against him, tempted to neglect other needs. My husband has devoted his interest almost entirely to the building up of the cause of God, regardless of his own personal interests, and at the sacrifice of the social enjoyment with his family. In his devotion to the cause, he has frequently endangered his health and life. He has been so much pressed with the burden of this work that he has not had suitable time for study, meditation, and prayer. God has not required him to be in this position, even for the interest and progress of the publishing work at Battle Creek. There are other branches of the work, other interests of the cause, that have been neglected through his devotion to this one. Disease and discouragement from overwork. James has done single-handed the work of three men. Here is where the mistake has been made by his brethren in urging him and by himself in consenting to stand under the burdens and responsibilities that he had borne alone for years. Nature has been outraged time and again. While his brethren have found fault with him for doing so much, they have not come up to take their share of the responsibilities, but have been too willing to make him responsible for everything. God-given gifts of fidelity, energy, and insight. Ellen White saw on the judgment ledger in heaven, under the head of fidelity, was the name of my husband. James had ready judgment and clear discernment, which have been gained through training and exercise, she said. God has given him the power to form and execute plans with the needed firmness, because he did not refuse to exercise these qualities of the mind and to venture in order to advance the work of God. Leaders in God's church today may err, but if they will stand in defense of the truth without yielding a single principle to please the best friend, and be bold and fearless in acting and speaking as did James White, if they will exercise their God-given qualities of mind and venture in order to advance the work of God, he will give the power to form and execute plans with the needed firmness. Just such firmness and decision were necessary at the commencement of the work, and they have been needed all along as it progressed step by step. Where are the James Whites of today that our church needs as it faces these turbulent, testing times? Next, we will hear Streams of Light, the Publishing Work, by Richard Cooper. On May 5, 1949, a centennial issue of the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald was published. F.D. Nickel included in his editorial Ellen G. White's words, "We have nothing to fear for the future, except as we shall forget the way the Lord has led us and his teaching in our past history." God's leading in the development of the publishing work is remarkable. James White, the man he chose to begin this work, did not hesitate to go forward once he received the divine mandate. The years immediately following the Great Disappointment were a time of intense activity for the pioneers. They traveled extensively to encourage the shaken believers to shore up their faith, and they continued searching the scriptures for greater light on the sanctuary and the real significance of October 22, 1844. The pioneers were young, energetic, enthusiastic, and mostly quite poor. They shared an unshakable faith in a soon-coming Savior. Some method was necessary to more efficiently extend their efforts. James and Ellen White attended a meeting in Dorchester, Massachusetts, in November 1848, where Ellen received a vision about the proclamation of the sealing message. As Ellen came out of vision, she turned to her husband and said, "I have a message for you. You must begin to print a little paper and send it out to the people. Let it be small at first, but as the people read, they will send you means with which to print, and it will be a success from the first. From this small beginning, it was shown to me to be like streams of light that went clear round the world." We look back with a good degree of pleasure to the month of July 1849, when we published the first number of the little paper called Present Truth. We sat down to prepare the matter for that little sheet and wrote every word of it, our entire library comprising a 3-shilling pocket Bible, Cruden's Condensed Concordance, and Walker's Old Dictionary minus one of its covers. Destitute of means, our hope of success was in God. James had 1,000 copies of the first edition of Present Truth published. He did not have enough money to pay the printer to fold them. He took them home where other believers helped fold and bundle them for mailing. Trips to the post office and printer were 16-mile round-trip walks for James, no easy task for one who walked with a limp at the best of times. When believers learned of the need for money to support the publication, the response was swift and generous. One can only stand in awe of the energy and determination of James White and the other pioneers. With so few workers, they simply had to mix traveling and speaking with the publication deadlines. Ellen White commented on this to Brother and Sister Collins. "We should have written you before, but we have had no certain abiding place, but have traveled in rain, snow, and blow with the child from place to place. I could not get the time to answer any letters, and it took all of James's time to write for the paper and get out the hymn book." By November 1850, 11 issues of Present Truth had been printed in Middletown, New York, and Paris, Maine. Working with Joseph Bates, J. N. Loughborough, S. W. Rhodes, and J. N. Andrews, James began publishing the Review to affirm and clarify the key truths accepted by the believers. The magazine started as an 8-page journal published on a biweekly basis. Sometimes the regularity of publication was hindered because pioneer leaders had to travel and thus could not meet their deadlines. James sometimes simply delayed publication until the necessary articles arrived. The publishing work had moved to Rochester, New York in 1852, and a hand press, type, and other goods costing $652.95 were purchased. In 1853, Uriah Smith joined the publishing team and worked as business manager, editor, and auditor at various times over the next 50 years. By 1855, James White had contributed all the money he had and incurred a $2,500 personal debt. Little wonder he was physically ill. On December 4, 1855, the first publication rolled off the press at Battle Creek. Between 1857 and 1873, $6,000 of power and cylinder presses were purchased due to increasing needs. In 1874, publishing work spread to the West Coast, using equipment purchased in New York by James White. A meeting in the Michigan Conference voted a full organizational plan for the publishing work, largely resulting from the need to adequately care for buildings and printing equipment. Official organization had to wait until the state of Michigan made laws of its own, hence the incorporation date of May 3, 1861. James White was appointed president of the corporation as well as editor of the review. His salary for such a challenging task was $7 per week. James was actively involved in the publishing work of the church till the end of his life. He gave his best energies and resources in acting on the challenge given him through Ellen's vision. After he died, the publishing work continued to prosper. The Battle Creek Presses eventually had a 50,000-square-foot working area. Fire brought tragedy to the work and transfer to Tacoma Park. In spite of relocation challenges, the press produced and marketed steadily growing numbers of books and periodicals. 1904, $63,000 of books. 1912, $203,000 of books and $33,000 of periodicals. 1923, $679,000 of books, $295,000 of periodicals. The following statement from his editorial for the first issue of the review reveals James' unshakable belief in the urgency of the message that provided the driving force to inspire him and the other pioneers in the publishing work. He declared, "The Review and Herald is designed to be strictly confined to those important truths that belong to the present time, a simple and clear exposition of those great and sanctifying truths embraced in the message of the third angel." In the centennial edition of the review, F.D. Nickel declared, "We would carry you over the road marked out by God and trod by the pioneers. We would encourage you with us to keep walking steadily forward on that path, for it leads to the gates of the New Jerusalem. Nor are those shining gates far distant. We are nearing home." And now for the biographical sketch, James White, A Man of Action, by Marlene Steinweg. Lord, have mercy on Brother White. He is proud and will be damned unless he gets rid of his pride. Have mercy, Elder H.'s voice droned on. James understood immediately that the elder sought to cast fear upon those around, bring them under his influence, that they might show him all that respect which his especial endowments demanded. Having had experience with hypocrites, he wisely challenged the man, declaring himself innocent of the charge which was made because James wore a starched, though borrowed, collar. Brother H. wept as though his heart would break, causing James to comment wryly, "To see a coarse, hard-hearted man possessing but little more tenderness than a crocodile, and nearly as destitute of moral and religious training as a hyena, shedding hypocritical tears for effect, is enough to stir the mirthfulness of the gravest saint." Thus on this, as on other occasions, was revealed James' youthful vigor, forceful character, and special humor that would be refined and put to use in God's work. His dedicated Christian parents, 4 older and 4 younger siblings, must have marveled to see how God worked in his life. A weak, sickly child with an eye disability that prevented formal studies until age 19, he completed basic studies after only 6 weeks, taught his first school the following term, was converted completely to the Millerite message by age 21, and became a preacher by age 22. A poor, itinerant preacher, James embarked upon his ministry with his Bible, some Millerite literature, a prophetic chart, 3 personally prepared lectures, and his youthful zest and strong faith. Though he met with opposition, suffered hard times, and braved discouraging weather, he undauntedly moved forward. The 1,000 souls converted on his first 6-week tour were clear evidence of this youthful preacher's power source. James had a fine presence and sturdy character, was a born leader, a strong, dynamic spirit, unusually bold, resourceful, and far-seeing. He had the happy gift of carrying people along with him, was enthusiastic, and possessed a grace and a dignity that kept every enterprise with which he had to do on a high spiritual level. The prophetic date Miller had set passed with no appearance of Christ. When at the famous Exeter, New Hampshire camp meeting, James heard S.S. Snow's clear presentation that Jesus would appear on the 10th day of the 7th Jewish month, he immediately joined other inspired Advent preachers proclaiming, "Behold, the bridegroom cometh," on October 22, 1844. "Go ye out to meet him." When Jesus failed to return on October 22, 1844, God sustained his belief in the prophetic interpretation. He then searched for understanding regarding the prophecy. Early in 1845, he accepted the message written by O.R.L. Crozier and printed in the Day Dawn, which revealed the truth about the heavenly sanctuary. In February 1845, James heard Ellen Harmon tell her visions and was convinced God had given her messages to instruct and comfort the Advent band. When he offered to accompany her in her travels to encourage the believers, she accepted his offer. After traveling and working by her side for 18 months, James, 25, and Ellen, 18, were married August 30, 1846. Mere youths, James and Ellen dedicated their lives to learning and preaching present truth as God would reveal it, and with other pioneers they eventually founded the Seventh-day Adventist Church. James White was instrumental in the development and understanding of the following basic SDA Bible doctrines. Number one, the prophetic reaffirmation of Jesus' imminent second advent. Number two, conditional immortality. Number three, definition of the three angels' messages, especially the third, as including Sabbath keeping as a test, Sunday keeping as a mark of the beast, and the importance of God's people to keep all the commandments. Number four, the premillennial second advent flanked by two resurrections, of the just dead at Jesus' advent and of the unjust dead after 1,000 years. Number five, the sanctuary doctrine, including the definition of the scapegoat as Satan. Number six, baptism by immersion only. And number seven, restoration of the prophetic gift. James was well known for his use of music in evangelism. He even published various hymnals for Advent worship. Imagine you were in the congregation there in the old meeting house at Battle Creek waiting for the preacher. Suddenly, the silence would be broken by a sweetly musical and strong, sure voice singing a familiar hymn. James White, silvery-haired, was coming down the aisle, beating time on his Bible and singing, "When I can read my title clear to mansions in the skies, I'll bid farewell to every fear and wipe my weeping eyes." By the time he had finished the first stanza and the chorus, the congregation had been caught and carried along in the spirit of it and was joining in. James delighted in using the Advent hymns to bring joy and inspiration to those fervent believers. Elder White was plagued with poor health throughout the years. He suffered from a bum ankle, indigestion, and strokes. He was overworked, overstressed, and truthfully intemperate in his great zeal to place present truth before the people. His life was snuffed out prematurely in a matter of days when he contracted malaria in 1881. In spite of his physical weakness and early death, God had used James to lead towards immense progress in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Of what other man could it be reported that he was a key theologian in framing the basic platform of Seventh-day Adventist belief and practice, that though attacked for his position on the matter, he gave form and solidity to the growing movement by encouraging and leading out in church organization, that he gave his life to establish worldwide publishing, health, and education ministries, and was instrumental in expanding the mission outreach of the Three Angels' messages in the West Coast and around the world. The urgency and intensity of his dedication speaks to the remnant today from the first article in the first journal, Present Truth. What is done to spread the truth must be done quickly. The four angels are holding the angry nations in check but a few days until the saints are sealed. Then the nations will rush like the rushing of many waters. Then it will be too late to spread before precious souls the present, saving, living truths of the Holy Bible. May God help the scattered remnant to receive the truth and be established in it. May they haste to take shelter beneath the covering of Almighty God, is my prayer. You will see your Lord a-coming in a few more days. Hear the band of heavenly music sounding through the air. And now we'll hear When God Speaks, with comments by Ellen White taken from the first volume of the Testimonies, pages 515 through 518. Few realize the constant wearing labor of those who are bearing the responsibilities of the work in the office. They are confined within doors day after day and week after week, while a constant strain upon the mental powers is surely undermining their constitutions and lessening their hold on life. These brethren are in danger of breaking suddenly. They are not immortal, and without a change they must wear out and be lost to the work. When Ellen White made this statement, she was including her husband, James. She emphasized the importance of taking time to rest and recreate. June 5, 1862, in that great vision on health given at Oswego, New York, Ellen was shown that her husband should preserve his strength and health, for God had yet a great work for them to do. Constant and excessive labor was exhausting his fund of strength, which God would have him preserve, that if he continued to overtask his physical and mental energies as he had been doing, he would be using up his future resources of strength, and would break down prematurely, and the cause of God would be deprived of his labor. This lesson was learned the hard way by James and Ellen, because when the warning went unheeded, James had a stroke. And yet this happened time and again. Sometimes, after prayer in his behalf, he would be healed. Other times he was not. Finally, when malaria attacked his weakened body, and he was unable to fight its ravages, he died, having barely reached his 60th birthday. Some of the brethren to whom this counsel was directed did not heed it and, by early deaths, were prematurely lost to the cause. J. N. Andrews lived to be only 54. J. H. Wagner, 69, and Uriah Smith, 72. Others heeded the warning and perhaps as a result lived longer. Among these were George Butler, 84, Stephen Haskell, 89, and J. N. Loughborough, 92. When God speaks, he means what he says. When he cautions, it becomes those noticed to take heed. The reason why I now speak publicly is that the same caution which was given to my husband has been given to others connected with the office. Unless they change their course of action, they are just as liable to be stricken down as was my husband. We've included in this issue an additional article entitled Ellen and James White Comment on the Battle for James's Health. The references come from three sources: Testimonies, Volume 3, pages 9 to 13, Second Selected Messages, pages 306 through 308, and Testimonies, Volume 1, pages 106 to 110. While at Paris, Maine, I was shown that my husband's health was in a critical condition, that his anxiety of mind had been too much for his strength. When the Present Truth was first published, he put forth great exertion and labored with but little encouragement or help from his brethren. From the first, he has taken burdens upon him which were too taxing for his physical strength. These burdens, if equally shared, need not have been so wearing. While my husband took much responsibility, some of his brethren in the ministry were not willing to take any. When we overtax our strength and become exhausted, we are liable to take cold, and at such times there is danger of disease assuming a dangerous form. We must not leave the care of ourselves with God when He has placed that responsibility upon us. Some ministers among us fail to bear all the responsibility that God would have them. This lack throws extra labor upon those who are burden-bearers. Many years ago, in 1865, while my husband was bearing heavy responsibilities in Battle Creek, the strain began to tell on him. His health failed rapidly. Finally, he broke down in mind and body and was unable to do anything. My friend said to me, "Mrs. White, your husband cannot live." I determined to remove him to a place more favorable for his recovery. His mother said, "Ellen, you must remain and take care of your family." "Mother," I replied, "I will never allow that masterly brain to fail entirely. I will work with God, and God will work with me to save my husband's brain." Constantly I kept my husband working at little things. I would not allow him to remain quiet, but tried to keep him active. This is the plan that physicians and helpers in our sanitariums should pursue. Lead the patients along step by step, keeping their minds so busily occupied that they have not time to brood over their own condition. I made him exercise his mind. If he had not been made to use his mind, in a little while it would have completely failed. Daily, my husband went out for a walk. In the winter, a terrible snowstorm came, and Father thought he could not go out in the storm and snow. I went to Brother Rude and said, "Brother Rude, have you a spare pair of boots?" "Yes," he answered. "I should be glad to borrow them this morning," I said. Putting on the boots and starting out, I tracked a quarter of a mile in the deep snow. On my return, I asked my husband to take a walk. He said he could not go out in such weather. "Oh, yes, you can," I replied. "Surely you can step in my tracks." That morning he took his usual walk. In the spring there were fruit trees to be set out and garden to be made. "Willie," I said, "please buy 3 hoes and 3 rakes. Be sure to buy 3 of each. When he brought them to me, I told him to take 1 of the hoes and Father another. Father objected, but took 1. Taking 1 myself, we began work, and although I blistered my hands, I led them in the hoeing. Father could not do much, but he went through the motions. It was by such methods as these that I tried to cooperate with God in restoring my husband to health. And oh, how the Lord blessed us! I always took my husband with me when I went out driving, and I took him with me when I went to preach at any place. I had a regular circuit of meetings. I could not persuade him to go into the desk while I preached. Finally, after many, many months, I said to him, "Now, my husband, you are going into the desk today." He did not want to, but I would not yield. I took him up into the desk with me. That day he spoke to the people. Although the meeting house was filled with unbelievers, for half an hour I could not refrain from weeping. My heart was overflowing with joy and gratitude. I knew that the victory had been gained. After 18 months of constant cooperation with God in the effort to restore my husband to health, I took him home again. Presenting him to his parents, I said, "Father, Mother, here is your son." After his recovery, my husband lived for a number of years, during which time he did the best work of his life. The hand of God in his restoration was most apparent. Probably no other one upon whom such a blow has fallen ever recovered. Yet a severe shock of paralysis, seriously affecting the brain, was by the good hand of God removed from his servant, and new strength granted him both in body and mind. I have given you this brief recital of personal experience in order to show you that I know something about the use of natural means for the restoration of the sick. God will work wonders for every one of us if we work in faith, acting as we believe that when we cooperate with Him, He is ready to do His part. I desire to do everything I can to lead my brethren to pursue a sensible course in order that their efforts may be the most successful. Many who have gone down into the grave might today be living if they had cooperated with God. Let us be sensible men and women in regard to these matters. Before James White died, he expressed his deep concern for the work he had worked so hard to build up. In my relations to this cause, I have been longest and most closely connected with the publishing work. Three times have I fallen, stricken with paralysis, through my devotion to this branch of the cause. Now that God has given me renewed physical and mental strength, I feel that I can serve His cause as I have never been able to serve it before. I must see the publishing work prosper. It is interwoven with my very existence. My life has been given to the upbuilding of these institutions. It seems like death to leave them. They are as my children, and I cannot separate my interest from them. These institutions are the Lord's instrumentalities to do a specific work. Satan seeks to hinder and defeat every means by which the Lord is working for the salvation of men. If the great adversary can mold these institutions according to the world's standard, his object is gained. I would rather die than live to see these institutions mismanaged or turned aside from the purpose for which they were brought into existence. Ellen White expressed the following anxieties in the spring and early summer of 1881, when she and James were planning to return to the Pacific Coast and dedicate their time to writing. My husband desired to present more fully the glorious subject of redemption, and I had long contemplated the preparation of important books. We were to attend a tent meeting at Charlotte, North Carolina, Sabbath and Sunday, July 23 and 24. Little did I think, as we traveled on, that this was the last journey we would ever make together. The weather changed suddenly from oppressive heat to chilling cold. My husband took cold, but thought his health so good that he would receive no permanent injury. He labored in the meeting at Charlotte, presenting the truth with clearness and power. On our return home, my husband complained of slight indisposition, yet he engaged in his work as usual. On Monday, July 31, he had a severe chill, and the next day I, too, was attacked. Together we were taken to the sanitarium for treatment. It was malaria. By Friday, Ellen, though greatly weakened, had taken a turn for the better, but James had not. She further commented, "I was taken to his room, and as soon as I looked upon his countenance, I knew that he was dying. I asked if Jesus was precious to him. He said, 'Yes, oh yes.' 'Have you no desire to live?' I inquired. He answered, 'No.' A peaceful expression rested upon his countenance. Sabbath morning, he had a chill which left him unconscious. At 5 p.m. Sabbath, August 6, 1881, he quietly breathed his life away, without a struggle or a groan. Side by side, we had labored in the cause of Christ for 36 years, including before marriage, and we hoped that we might stand together to witness the triumphant close, but such was not the will of God. The chosen protector of my youth, the companion of my life, the sharer of my labors and afflictions, has been taken from my side, and I am left to finish my work and to fight the battle alone."